This is Booktown. You're new here, aren't you? Maybe I should show you around. You can get anything you want here. Anything you want. Anything you desire. Anything you can imagine. It's all here. It's all free. It's all for you. Come on. I'll show you around. If you've got the guts. This is Booktown. You can get anything you want here. Anything you need. And this is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. I'll be with you till 2 p.m. Mostly, we have one event coming up, but mostly just talking books with a couple of very knowledgeable people around the community. People we have been in the habit of calling up every now and then, and one new person who's been here once before, but I think will be coming on more often. First person is John Dederich, who's KVMR's Camptonville correspondent. Welcome to Booktown, John.
Thank you, Eric. Thanks for having me.
About every 3 or 4 months, we just call John up to find out what he's been reading and what he's been thinking of what he's been reading. And at the end of the year, he's one of our panels that discusses their favorite books of the year. I should just give you a hint before we get into what you're reading right now that I was looking through an anthology from the 20s Vanity Fair magazine, quite different from the current one. And I noticed that they polled a number of people on the 10 dullest or 10 most boring authors they knew of. And I wonder if you might be able to come up with a list like that for the end of the year.
I'll work on that. I can certainly do that. There are some boring authors out there, some of whom have fabulously, you know, successful careers. And they must be read by boring people, I assume. Maybe. I don't know.
But you're not a boring person, and you've probably been reading some pretty interesting stuff.
Well, I hope I'm not boring. I'm sure I bore someone, no doubt. But I one of my favorite authors I've discovered just in the last few years, because he's only been writing the last few years, is David Mitchell, who's a British author who's written 4 books, all of them award-winning. First one was Ghostwritten, then Number 9 Dream, then Cloud Atlas, which was shortlisted for the Booker Prize. I believe Number 9 Dream was listed for the Booker Prize. And then his newest book is Black Swan Green, which is quite different. He's been a multiple narrative voice author until this book, where this is a singular book narrated by a 13-year-old boy with a stutter in England in 1982.
And I had the impression that this book was actually either nonfiction or very autobiographical.
I think there's a lot of his life in sort of the North Midlands growing up. In this book, it's such an amazing picture of a time. His descriptive writing is phenomenal. The angst that the boy goes through being picked on in school is quite credible, and it's also a historical novel. It's during the Falklands War, so it deals with death and loss and hubris and Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan and that marriage made in hell and all those political ramifications that were happening and Duran Duran, and it's rich. It's very entertaining. It's a fast read. It doesn't have the pretensions of his other books, which are literary and lofty in their aim. And this one is simpler. It's a Bildungsroman. It's a true coming-of-age novel, but charming. And let me read a section here for you real quick. This boy has been, he's been tortured, essentially, by this gang of kids, because he's not popular, and he was going to be popular, but then he blew it by, helping a friend in need, and he gets sort of blacklisted, and he's at a fair, and he sees the wallet of his arch enemy has been lost. And this is how he reacts to that. That ace song, Olive's Salami, by Elvis Costello and the Attractions, drowned out whatever Dean yelled at me, so I yelled back, "What was that?" Dean yelled back, "Can't hear a word you're saying." But then the fairground man tapped him on the shoulder for his 10p. That's when I saw a matte square on the scratched rink right by my Dodgem. He's in a bumper car, which is what he's calling a Dodgem. They're playing bumper cars. The matte square was a wallet. I'd have handed it in to the fairground man, but it flipped open to show a photo of Ross Wilcox and Don Madden, posed like John Travolta and Olivia Neutron Bomb on the Grease poster. Instead of sunny America, mind, it was a cloudy back garden down Wellington Gardens. Ross Wilcox's wallet was stuffed with notes. There had to be 50 quid in there. This was serious. More money than I've ever had. Putting the wallet between my knees, I looked around to check nobody'd seen. Dean was yelling whatever it was at Floyd Chaseley now. None of the kids in the queue was paying me any attention. The prosecution, A, pointed out that it wasn't my money, and B, considered the panic Ross Wilcox would feel when he'd lost all his money. The defense produced A, the dissected mouse head in my pencil case, B, the drawings of me eating my dick on blackboards, and C, the never-ending, "Hey, maggot, how's the speech therapy going on, maggot?" The judge arrived at his verdict in seconds. I stuffed Ross Wilcox's wallet in my pocket. I'd count my money later. And, of course, you know, he's a good lad, so he has a crisis in conscience eventually, and also it also proves to be a tactical success for him to eventually return the wallet. It's really fun. It's just a fun read. And warm. He's a warm author. And this is the warmest of his four books, I will say that.
It was pretty much at your instigation that I read one of his novels. I'd previously read one story, and I read Number 9 Dream 6 months ago. I enjoyed it very much, but I felt that he was a young writer. He had two... There were a number of different things going on, but he had sort of two styles he would fall into among the various narrations, and one was sort of like Thomas Pynchon, and one was sort of like Haruki Murakami, mm-hmm. rather. Mm-hmm. And it strikes me that what you just read sounds like neither of them and sounds much much closer to the bone and much realer.
Yes, definitely. It's not nearly the sort of... this isn't... It's ironic because the first three books are, oh, look at me, I'm writing a stylistic tour de force. I'm going to get a lot of attention with these books, which, of course, they are, and he did. This sets out...
And you liked...
And I liked them. I liked them. You know, I thought they worked for me. And this one doesn't seem to set out to do that, and yet it becomes a stylistic tour de force. In not aiming so high, he hits the bullseye, seems to me, if that makes any sense. It's just, it's not pretentious. It's very direct and very human and very, we can relate to this boy. We can relate to the story. Whereas in Cloud Atlas, Number 9 Dream, they get so far gone that we can marvel at them, but they're not something that we can personally identify with.
And the title again?
Black Swan Green.
Which, as when I first heard of it, I almost immediately thought of Penny Lane or Strawberry Fields. It sort of has that same working class, trying to figure out where you are, somewhat dreamy but somewhat gritty.
Well, that's perceptive because it's the name of the housing development where he is. The name of his you know, block of flats. He lives in Black Swan Green. That's exactly the kind of environment that he's growing up in. It's quite good. I really recommend it. It's touching.
And other reads?
Well, you know, I'm teaching AP English at Colfax High School, and we are going to embark on Ford Madox Forge the Good Soldier. They don't know it yet, but they're going to. And so I reread this, and this is the third time I've read this book. I love this book. I think it's an extraordinary novel. It has that extraordinarily unreliable first-person narrator. And I just think that it's great. It's a novel of adultery, a novel of betrayal on many levels, a novel of deceit, a novel of a picture of an age, too. It really is that... sort of early 20th century, fin de siècle, a kind of civilization, society that we will never see again. And I just think it's just rich. Let me read you the first paragraph. "This is the saddest story I've ever heard. We had known the Ashburnhams for 9 seasons of the town of Nauheim with an extreme intimacy, or rather with an acquaintanceship as loose and easy and yet as close as a good glove with your hand. My wife and I knew Captain and Mrs. Ashburnham as well as it was possible to know anybody, and yet in another sense we knew nothing at all about them. This is, I believe, a state of things only possible with English people, of whom till today, when I sit down to puzzle out what I know of this sad affair, I knew nothing whatever. 6 months ago, I had never been to England, and certainly had never sounded the depths of an English heart. I had known only the shallows."
Well, yeah. Now, most people, when you say the good soldier to them, they say, "This is the saddest story I ever heard."
Yeah, exactly, because they know, because that's certainly one of the best and most ironic first lines that anyone ever wrote.
Now, you were talking about this the last time you joined us on Booktown, and at that time I didn't know you were reading it in preparation for school, and it encouraged me to go back. I read it, I figured out from some internal notes in the copy of the book I had, I was 18 when I read it.
Uh-huh.
And what I remember of it is that it had to do with two couples. I didn't remember that one was American, one was English.
Right.
That it had adultery and deceit in it, and that it was very elegantly written, but that was all. Now when I go back, and read it, and I just wonder, how much could I have understood at 18? I notice that I have check marks and underlinings and marginal notes and everything, and I know I was trying very hard to get into the changing, twisting emotions among these four mm-hmm. people, or really mm-hmm. five people, but I'm sure I couldn't have gotten it all. And now I wonder, will your students be able to get it? It's very subtle.
It's extremely subtle, and I think there are two things there. One is, of course, there's no substitute for life experience. And, you know, my hope would be, okay, these kids are going to read it at 18. Maybe they'll return later, you know, at 30, 40, 50, whenever, and read it again. And then when they read it again, it's going to be an entirely different novel. Well, I remember where I read it when I was young, like you, and I thought, wow, this is a great, well-written book. Wow, what an interesting story. Wow, what a surprise. But then when I read it again, I realized how funny it is. There's this humor, this black, underlying, dark, guilty chuckle through a lot of this that I think you can only get through having lived and had some experiences in the third world, you know, on the material plane here, in the third dimension, that there's no substitute for that. On the other hand, I think my students can certainly admire the artistry and can certainly appreciate the imagery, the ironic tone. I'm really going to teach it from the standpoint of the unreliable narrator. And we're going to take it from that and go from there. So we're looking at it as a succession of literary devices. But you're right, there's no way you can appreciate this. I mean, I read War and Peace in my 20s. You know, I'm sure if I picked it up tomorrow and wanted to wade through 1,200 pages of it, which would be immensely rewarding, I have no doubt, it would be a completely different novel to me.
The things that struck me were the unreliability of the narrator. He really does not know what's going on. Mm-hmm. Even when things are thrown in his face, it takes him another 5 months to figure it out.
Well, he lies to us.
Yeah.
I think he's a liar. And with a nod and a wink, you know, knowing that we know that he's a liar and still lies. And that's just marvelous. It's just it's like the layers of the onion. You just peel one back, peel one back, peel one back, and there's more and more and more to be revealed.
But the other thing that struck me this time was just what a ghastly, truly ghastly situation these people had put themselves in just from following the rules of society or the rules of religion.
Yes. It really is about repression of all kinds and the trap. People talk about the collapse of the American family, but, you know, quite frankly, a lot of people should get divorced. I mean, you should divorce. And certainly that's the case in this novel. And, of course, the one woman is Catholic. And that's not the question.
Two, actually.
Oh, that's right. That's right. And so it becomes... it's an impossibility. So they get their best solution, which is no solution at all.
One thing that occurred to me the other day, we briefly mentioned what we were going to talk about on this program, and you said one of the things you were going to tell your students about was his use of irony, which is unlike modern irony. And as I thought about that, I thought that so much modern irony in contemporary fiction is really just sort of attenuated sarcasm.
I think that's very true. I think it's obvious. I think we, you know, everybody is sort of copped to the idea of, oh, this is the age of irony. Let's be ironic. And therefore, it kind of loses its bite. It becomes kind of blatant, and eventually, I don't even think you notice it anymore, because it doesn't. It's not insightful. It doesn't lead to any deeper understanding. But life is ironic. Of course, there are ironies in life. Duh. You know. So, but to have someone subtly lay it out for you in a masterful literary way is really entertaining, and I think extremely rare.
And the narrator, the unreliable narrator, at some point toward the end, repeats the phrase saddest story, as he does several times, and says, it was such a sad story, but I wouldn't call it a tragedy because there just wasn't the grandeur involved. But it is like a Greek tragedy, in that the original irony of Greek tragedy was the protagonist or the protagonists not knowing what was going on. And this is just happens again and again at different levels of misunderstanding each other or misunderstanding the situation, and it leads to disaster for them all.
Exactly. And I think my students appreciate on that level, because I've pounded Aristotle into them. Let me read another passage that you were alluding to just now. This is later in the book. This is about two-thirds of the way through. He says, I call this the saddest story, rather than the Ashburnham tragedy, just because it is so sad, just because there was no current to draw things along to a swift and inevitable end. There's about it none of the elevation that accompanies tragedy. There's about it no nemesis, no destiny. Here were two noble people, for I'm convinced that both Edward and Leonora had noble natures. Here, then, were two noble natures drifting down life, like fire ships afloat on a lagoon, and causing miseries, heartaches, agony of the mind, and death. And they themselves steadily deteriorated. And why? For what purpose? To point what lesson? It is all a darkness. It's wonderful.
Yes.
And, yes, it is not a tragedy. It is not elevated. To call their natures noble, well, that's sort of like if you're a communist and you're calling them noble. Not a compliment.
When Ford wrote this, he was 40 years old, and it turned out half a dozen novels, and said that he wanted this to be the work he stood or fell on. After this, he wrote the Parade's End tetralogy, which I think some people would consider just as good.
But which I haven't read.
One person, one of his friends, admiring younger friends, said, this is the greatest novel in the English language. And then another, more perceptive friend said, no, it's the greatest French novel in the English language.
That's very true. I like that a lot. Yeah, because it's French in the sense of it delights in its wordplay. It's about deceit and adultery, which is a very, 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 very prevalent French theme. Madame Bovary comes to mind, and Therese Racan, and all kinds of other things. And it's subtle. It's just you could miss it. There's things in here that you could miss without a close read, and yet if you read it closely, you're going to be rewarded, and you're going to also eventually, once you get through the shock of it, you're going to get down to that sort of laughter and that sort of deep, deep chuckle at what fools people are and can be to one another. It's a marvelous book. Ford was an important guy. He was a publisher and was important in helping. You know, people establish their careers, people like D.H. Lawrence. The list is long and endless. He was a friend to many. He was a literary giant.
And he was also, for a while, a collaborator with Joseph Conrad. I think Conrad maybe got tired of writing out every paragraph, and I guess he might have had told Ford, well, this is what I want to do, and Ford wrote it out, and then Conrad rewrote it, or something like that. But I know three novels, among them, The Secret Agent, he was part of.
Which is a wonderful book.
Now, we don't have too much more time, but you told me you had a surprise as well.
Oh, did I? Well, you know, I think we should table that surprise, because I don't think we have enough time. So can I come on again and surprise you?
Well, you can certainly come on in Christmas Day, we are hoping to have our best of the year, and I should warn people in advance that we are actually going to be in the studio between opening our presents and eating our turkey.
Indeed.
Or
so.
whatever it is we do.
Whatever it is that we'll do. We will do that then, and then I will surprise you.
Okay. Any other little thoughts?
I'm full of little thoughts. I don't have any big thoughts. But I would suggest that people go out and you know, just read. Pick up something and read it. You know, find something good. Go to the library. Spend time.
And the best thing, go ahead.
And by all means, I recommend David Mitchell. And if you're not reading David Mitchell, you should read Peter Ackroyd. If you're not reading Peter Ackroyd, pick up let's see, Atonement, Ian McEwan, who I would love to talk about at some point again, because I went back and read a number of Ian McEwan novels after I read Atonement, which I thought was one of the best things I've read in many years. I just loved it. And read his subsequent novel, Saturday, and then went back and read Amsterdam and laughed out loud. How rare is it to read a novel where you just bent over double in laughter? And that book for me was Amsterdam by Ian McEwan, which won the Booker Prize the year of its publication. And beyond that, I think we'll let readers go out and discover literary jewels of their own.
Well, you know, I happened to lock you in this time, which I rarely do with telephones, and the phone is ringing, so let's just see if it's someone who wants to talk to you.
Okay.
Hello, listener, you're on the air. Are you here to talk to John?
Yeah, hello. I'm one of John's old students. I'm Chris Stormbringer, and I'm reading this book right now called Crusaders in Hell, and it's by Janet Morris, and each chapter is written by a different artist. It's got Gregory Bedford, C.J. Cherish, David Drake, Bill Kirby, and more. And it's all about these celebrities, mainly, that get sent down to hell and or that are in hell, and they're trying to figure a way out. And each chapter is completely different.
That sounds interesting. What's the title again, Chris?
It's called Crusaders in Hell.
Crusaders in Hell.
Got, like, you know, it's got like things that are kind of out of place. You know, it's got like Achilles and driving a, you know, a Black Hawk helicopter, and it's got Napoleon who's using an Uzi and stuff. You know, and you know, Caesar's kind of running the show down there, and it's really neat. One of the chapters has got a mathematician and a philosopher, and you know, the mathematician's all to the philosopher. He's like, "Well, I bet you're surprised." And he's like, "Well, what are you talking about?" He's like, "Well, I seem to remember reading one of your books that said that there isn't an afterlife, you know, and that it's a bunch of rubbish and stuff, and here we are and stuff, you know." And like they each chapter kind of gets into a different aspect.
Interesting.
about different about even the whole existence of anything.
You know, did you know, and readers may not know, but that's the third book in a trilogy. That's a trilogy of books. There's Heroes in Hell and what's the other one? Rebels in Hell, is
Rebels
it?
In Hell. I don't know. Yeah, it says, Heroes in Hell, and the series started Richard, the Lionhearted, Napoleon. Let's see, my cover's kind of really messed up.
Yeah.
So we got to go now, but what's the title again and the author?
It's called Crusaders in Hell by Janet Morris. Is like the big one there at the top. Yeah, it says it's in a part of a series, and I'd like to find the other series part two. Maybe is it Ames? Are you still doing stuff at Ames?
No, but we'll talk about that some other time.
All right. Hey, I love your show though, man. Love you too there, Mr. Eric Tome. You guys have a good rainy day.
Okay.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Chris.
Thanks.
Good day for a book.
Yeah. Good day for a book indeed.
See you guys.
So, John, we'll talk with you again on Christmas afternoon.
Looking forward to it.
Okay. Thanks for being with us.
Yeah, thank you very much, Eric. Bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you. And you're still listening to Booktown on KVMR-FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome, and I'm going to be with you for a little less than half an hour. In the next 15 or 20 minutes, we're going to talk with a scholar who's been with us several times, but always in a sort of general way, discussing a few things that we've had in mind. But I'm hoping that this will be the beginning of an oncoming series, which in my mind I'm calling Great Dead Anarchists. And the laugh that you just heard was that of Barry Pateman, who's one of the editors of the Emma Goldman papers and one of the stalwarts of AK Press, which is going to be having an evening up in Grass Valley in a couple of weeks. I'll tell you about that later. We were at the Gold Rush Book Fair a couple of months ago, and one of the books I had was Love's Coming of Age by Edward Carpenter, which I wasn't familiar with. Barry was, and I remembered only that I'd read sections of Carpenter's book, Civilization, Its Cause and Cure, which I'd loved as much for its title as anything else. And it turned out that Barry knows quite a lot about Edward Carpenter, and he's agreed to come on and talk about one of these great dead anarchists. No more smirking.
Hi, thank you, Eric. It's nice to be here with you again.
So who was Edward Carpenter, and why should we read him?
Well, Edward Carpenter was an English writer, philosopher, political scientist, poet. He was born in 1844 and lived until 1929. Was a churchman, left the church after he'd been influenced by Walt Whitman and others, and produced a body of work, I think, that is prescient in its ideas and its themes. Is relatively well written at times. It can be rather gauche and awkward, but other times very, very powerful and moving. And I think was also in his own self, in his own personal struggles with his sense and his realization that he was gay. All those three ideas, those three elements interact, I think, to make him a most fascinating character, a man who was well, well ahead of his time, extraordinarily modern, if we can use such a term, with his ideas, and certainly someone who seems unfairly to have drifted off into the mists of oblivion, apart from the loyal following he has.
From what I've read from a brief Wikipedia entry, he was not only one of the first people in England to have an openly homosexual relationship. He lived with one man for most of his life, George Merrill.
Yes.
But it was one of the first openly cross-class relationships. That he had been he'd been upper class, had gone to Cambridge, but he was living with a man from the working classes, and I guess that was just as radical.
Yes, it was. He basically abandoned what you and I would call, and our listeners, the middle-class wealthy life. His father had been independently wealthy and left Edward a little bit of money, and he bought land and property near Sheffield in England. Sheffield is a rather industrial city, but just outside Sheffield is really quite astonishingly beautiful countryside and rather rich land. And he worked there. He worked on the land and deliberately and I think because of his political beliefs, sought out working class men and women and argued very much that he was very happy and much happier there than he was in the dreaming spires of Cambridge.
And he was a early, I guess you'd say, not home gardener. He actually grew crops to sell. He learned a number of manual trades.
Yes, he was a market gardener. And he, very much in the sense of wanting to put his ideas into practice, he was a socialist anarchist. He believed in, I think, really a rather early form of anarchist communism, where everyone gives what they can and takes what they need. And he tried to operate the working land and his little business of market gardening, growing crops, selling them on, and employing men and women in that light. For him, I think, he was very wary of... He did, like many radicals at that time, love nature.
He saw nature, I think, as an escape, as something that was rather wonderful. And there one could find peace and solace that you could find, that you could not find in the corrupt stews of the cities and all that was civilization. But he shared Morris's view about Thoreau, I think, which said that, you know, both of them saw that, or felt that Thoreau acted his life out as a spectator, that he watched and observed but didn't take part. And for both of them, they wanted to not celebrate life when they could, but create a society where life could be celebrated every day.
And in doing this, I guess he joined innumerable parties. He was a member of several early labor parties.
Yes.
And took part in actions about criminal trials. There was one anarchist trial that I guess he took a very strong stand on, and in general was out there promoting his ideas, writing about them, and then trying to live them too.
Yes, he did try that awful problem that we all have of having our ideals and then trying to make them real. Yes, he was involved in some in many groups, all of the left. He was involved in arguing and protecting and defending anarchists who'd been wrongly imprisoned, he felt, by his young provocateurs. He was involved in all sorts of issues in his life. He was involved in anti-vivisection. He was anti-capital punishment. He was anti-prison. He argued for the abolition of cruel sports. He argued that the mechanics of the world, mechanical ideas and inventions, science, should be used to serve man and not the other way around. Of course, he argued for women's rights. And he argued very strongly in books like The Intermediate Sex that to be homosexual, to be gay now, as we would say, is actually normal and healthy. It's not the Krafft-Ebing neurosis. It was actually a normal thing to be. He was also, of course, anti-imperialist. And you couple all of that with this desire and this belief that there was something in working-class life that was simple and honorable, that was perhaps the only thing that could save us from the civilization that he so hated. You get a picture of this man who was thinking and feeling and acting on a variety, a huge amount of fronts, yet trying to weave this sort of thread that held everything together.
Now, since I've read a number of his writings, mostly ones that you selected for me since we first started talking about him last spring, and I see that although he was involved in movements and helped found the Independent Labor Party and so on, his main cure for civilization was to live simpler.
Yes, it was. He sort of, like as I said earlier, he certainly felt that nature and the simple life was the way forward. But he stopped at the sort of John Ruskin's idea of a sort of medieval guild. For him, the simpler life meant finding pleasure in your day-to-day companions. He was influenced by William Godwin, who would talk about a small circle of companions who you could have faith and confidence with all your life. And that's what he was certainly interested in and believed in. But yes, he believed in living simply. He believed in honest and good relationships that were not based on hypocrisy or hierarchy. And for whatever reason, in whatever way, he felt it was to be found especially in working class communities rather than in the middle class world that his family had come from.
And this is sort of ironic. I guess his relationship with George Merrill was apparently the inspiration for E.M. Forster's Morris.
Forster visited Carpenter in Millhope in 1913 and mentions in a letter rather chastely that George Merrill touched his buttocks. Morris was certainly based on the idea of a middle class or a wealthier man having a relationship with, in this case, Scudder, the gamekeeper, this working class man of the soil, this man of nature. And there seems to be little doubt that Forster saw in Carpenter's relationship with Merrill something that he wanted to develop and work on and write about.
And I've even seen it suggested that D.H. Lawrence's Lady Chatterley's lover is sort of a heterosexualized version of the same relationship.
It's quite possible. I think that for many writers in England at that time, and we have to be careful about being too general, of course, but that class, crossing that class divide, was absolutely important for them. You know, it was a fascinating, dangerous and challenging journey to make. It was rather, one stage, many of that class, of the middle class, had gone exploring the Orinoco, had gone into Africa, had gone into Asia. But now some of them were actually exploring their own country, the class that they never saw, the class that they saw out the corner of their eyes. And you can see that trend even in the works of George Orwell in The Road to Wigan Pier, where you explore this other world that is running parallel to you that you've had no experience of. And I think the same happened there, I think, with Lawrence, Anne Foster and others, who all wanted to explore that great divide.
And it's funny you mention Orwell, because he does, in The Road to Wigan Pier, he makes fun of the sandal-wearing, vegetarian, yes, yes, fruit-drinking socialists. And I guess Carpenter was the first person to make sandals in England.
I don't know if he was. I mean, I think it's been claimed that he has. But yes, he was, except that Carpenter wasn't quite that cliché. There was a harder edge to Carpenter. You know, there was in him a much... He wasn't a pacifist, he wasn't beatific, he saw the need, in his great poem, this great masterpiece of his, Towards Democracy, which is, you know, both his first publication and one he keeps adding to all of his life, he works on continually. He makes the point that, you know, the revolution, the change will not come peacefully, it will not be easy, it will be hard, we will have to work at it. And he was very, very supportive, both financially and in his actions, of trade unions and working class organizations. So he wasn't quite the hippie, the dropout bearded strange vegetarians that Orwell despised as much. He may have gone to the simple life, but he was always very, very class conscious.
And I know that you mentioned the unevenness of his writing.
Yes.
Sometimes he goes into long rhetorical spurts, I guess you'd say, that are a bit embarrassing, but then his analyses, when he gets down to look at a concrete economic situation, they are amazingly precise.
Yes, almost breathtakingly so at times. I think you're right. And I think he isn't a naturally smooth, sophisticated writer. He's actually a very passionate writer. I think sometimes he only wrote when he felt very strongly about something. And when he does, he's got both the strength and the weakness of that, where... You're right, there's a sort of awful, sometimes it goes round and round and round and round, and then all of a sudden it hits on a point that just thumps you in the chest, and you think, my goodness, yes. So I think if our readers or our listeners want to read Carpenter, they've got to be prepared for that. But they're also going to read a person who is, I think, really, really quite sophisticated in his analysis of the world around him.
And he was also a poet, and I guess was strongly influenced by Walt Whitman.
Yes.
And I guess you say visited Walt Whitman.
Yes, he visited Whitman. He sort of suggested that he found in Leaves of Grass a sort of a living faith. He says he found in that poem itself a living faith, one that almost replaced his Christianity, because he soon abandoned Christianity. He visited Whitman in April 77. He met Whitman, then he met Emerson, he met Oliver Wendell Holmes, he met John Burroughs. And he went to visit Whitman again later on, just before Whitman died. And he was disappointed by what he found there. He found that Whitman was selfish. He felt that Whitman was against radical ideas. He was in favor of private enterprise. He wasn't the man who Carpenter thought he was. But there can be no gainsaying the enormous, enormous effect that Whitman had on Carpenter's life. And Towards Democracy is manifestly inspired by Leaves of Grass and this great, churning, rumbling, powerful writing that Whitman had with the celebration of humanity. But in Towards Democracy, it's a celebration of the working class, that change will come. What you should do, he argues in Towards Democracy, is live close to the earth and the people. And by the people, he means the ordinary workers who work that earth.
This is Booktown on KVMR-FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Thome. I've been talking with Barry Pateman, one of the editors of the Emma Goldman Papers and one of the stalwarts of AK Press, about the work of Edward Carpenter. I hope this will be one of a series of great dead anarchists that we'll do over the next year or two. And if you're interested in some of what you've heard, Barry will be participating in an evening with AK Press, which is America's foremost publisher and distributor of anarchist and radical literature, on Saturday, December 2nd at 7 p.m. at Jason's Studio Cafe at 134 South Auburn Street in Grass Valley. If you want to know more about that, call 273-7057. Well, I've got to move on now, Gary, but thank you so much for being with us, and I hope to do this again next spring.
It's been a pleasure, Eric, and thank you, and have a lovely day, everyone.
This is Booktown on KVMR-FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Thome. I'm going to be here for about 10, 11 more minutes. And in this time, I'm talking with Chris Olander, one of the main people behind the Nevada County Poetry Series, which has been going on how long now?
This is our completion of the seventh year.
Seventh year. And every year in November is the big finale for the series. You don't have readings in, I guess, July and December?
Right, that we take a 2 months off each year in preparation for our big party at the end of the year, which is November 16th, coming up on Thursday at 7:30 p.m.
And what this is going to be is, I guess, a giant open mic.
That's what it is. It's an open mic. It's a celebration for the release of our anthology, the NCPS 2006 anthology, which I have a copy of right here. We just got them printed up. And this is really a happy time for us. It's just like a party. As many people as we can get there, usually anywhere from 20 to 35 people show up to read their poems. And each person gets a little bit extra time this time because it is an open mic all night long.
On the list of readers in the back, there's a number of them I recognize, including Al Young, the former poet laureate, who is read last, was it February?
Yeah, he was our fundraiser in late January. We actually have two poet laureates here. We have Julia Connor as well, who is the poet laureate of Sacramento, as well as Al Young, the poet laureate of California, which he still is at the present time.
Still is, yeah. Former was incorrect. I apologize for that. And then you have a number of people listed here who I happen to know, but didn't know were poets, and I didn't know they had read it. I'm not going to throw out
it's
any
names. It's surprising
how
many there are here. This is probably the largest per capita of poets in the United States, I think.
who actually edited the anthology?
Julie Valin and myself edited this anthology. We've done the last three. Bill Gaynor did the first four, as long with help from the rest of us as well. But Julie and I were mainly responsible for getting these people in print here.
And every poem that's in the book was read at one of the poetry.
Right. The open mics section, which is in the back, there's 12 open mic readers. They read throughout the year. We have an open mic after the scheduled three featured readers. And also we did a reading for the National Poetry Month in your bookstore.
In April.
In April. We had one each Sunday. And we had a surprising amount of readers read for us during those 4 weeks. And so we have those represented in the back as well. Each one of those persons gets one page. The featured readers get 3 pages to send us whatever they feel like is their best work. That's what we try to do, is to convince them that, you know, send us the best work that you have, that you feel will represent you the best.
So it was a matter of, you just said, here's 3 pages, you send us the work. You didn't have them send you 10 pieces and pick out 2 or 3.
We gave them kind of a format in which what we were told them they would be. They usually send us anywhere from 1 to 4 or 5 pages. So there was a few of the poets who we had to eliminate 1 or 2 poems, as well as we had to edit down some of the work. A couple of, there's three prose pieces in here. Al Young had one. Beth Lissick and Tara Jempson each had prose pieces, and we did have to edit those down. So we tried to pick out what would be the most interesting aspect of those three writers.
Yeah, that's one of the things that jumped out at me. I don't remember if you've had prose in the anthology.
Yes, we
before.
Have. We have had that. You know, there's usually about 2 prose pieces from the poets each year.
So if somebody's coming to the reading on Thursday, how long does it normally go on, this final extravaganza?
Well, it all depends on how many readers we have. We've gone all the way until 1 o'clock before. However, you know, I'm a real fan of open mic readings because they keep coming. You get a different experience about every 10 minutes, and it seems to be they just keep getting better because you hear one poet read and say, oh, I've got one that's going to speak to that. Oh, I've got one that's even better than that. And so the energy just seems to keep generating. So I'm really a fan of open mic reads. I guess it comes from the California Poets in the Schools and their giant open mics. But I really encourage anyone who wants to read to come to this open mic on Thursday, November 16th.
What other things do you have planned for next year? Do you have any of your poets? I know you take December off because it's impossible to get people to come.
Right. Well, we're still planning to do more readings at the Center for the Arts, and most of the readings are in the Black Box Theater, as well as this reading coming up on Thursday the 16th will be in the Black Box Theater, which is behind the main building on Richardson Street. But we've got a couple of the dates scheduled for next year. The Cowboy Poets, that's in August, and we have our fundraiser in January, which is scheduled. The other dates we have scheduled, but we're still working out some of the schedule, and they're usually on a Thursday, the third Thursday of the month.
And are you going to do the Sunday readings in April again?
As far as I know, we are. If you're into it, we're into it. So.
Well, I can't decide. There's 15 of us.
Yeah, right.
But the people who were there were so enthusiastic that I think many people asked if you would continue it and do it during the full year. And as far as the reply I got was that if you did it every month, you'd be competing with yourself.
That's it, competition with ourselves. And it's surprising how, as I said, there's just hundreds of poets who live here, but it's surprising how many come out to the readings each month. I'm not so sure we could sponsor another one. So we're kind of set with this one right now.
Okay, this again is the giant open mic introducing the Nevada County Poetry Series Year 2006 Anthology. It's going to be at 7:30 p.m. or $1 for those under 18, and includes refreshments. It'll be at the off-center stage, which you can get. It's behind the Center for the Arts, but you can come into it from Richardson Street. And if you want more information, the number is 432-8196, or you can call the Center for the Arts, 274-8384. And anything more we need to know about it, Chris?
Yeah, I'd like to tell you, say this, and that is that these anthologies have sold out for the last 4 years. So if you want one, I really suggest you be there at the reading on November 16th, because they will sell out. We're printing a limited number, and it does show the quality of Nevada County poetry the series, as well as the poets who are writing here. So I really suggest you get one of these as soon as you can, because I doubt very seriously that we will have any for the bookstores.
So in past years, you've sold them all at the reading.
At the reading, right.
So I should feel pretty lucky to have one in my hands.
Yeah, you should, Eric. This is a collector's edition, and it's already worth more than what it was when you paid for it.
That is certainly true. So once again, this Thursday, November 16th, the open mic for the Nevada County Poetry Series season finale and your chance to get the year 2006 anthology. It'll be at 7:30 p.m. at the off-center stage behind the Center for the Arts. And then the other event I mentioned earlier this evening, Revolution by the Book, an evening with AK Press, America's foremost publisher and distributor of anarchist and radical literature, will be at Jason's Studio Cafe Saturday, December 2nd at 2006 at 7 p.m. And you can get more information about that at 273-7057. And this has been Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome, and I'm just getting out of here to make way for Jimmy Accardi's Rock and Roll Party.